I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. My mother was an avid bird watcher who kept lists of all the birds she had ever seen in her many travels. She was so smitten with these little creatures, she would gaze up into the sky while behind the wheel of the car, trying to figure out what species of bird had just caught her eye. That was taking her hobby just a bit too far, in my estimation. Now that I don't have cats, I have a few bird feeders in my backyard, and while I really don't know who or what I am observing, I have found bird behavior absolutely fascinating. Our guest science writer Jennifer Ackerman has a new book about what we're learning about the diversity and intelligence of birds and the complexity of their behaviors. It's titled The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think. And she joins us on Radio Times by Skype. And Jennifer Ackerman, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
We have so much to talk about, but let me ask you about the birds and the pandemic. And I have noticed, maybe I'm just paying more attention, I feel like I can hear birds in a way that I didn't several months ago. Are the birds enjoying this pandemic?
Well, I think that there is less ambient noise, so we are hearing them more. And also, I think people are paying more attention to birds. You know, we're all stuck in our homes, and you know, people are turning outward to their yards and really attending more to what's happening with birds. It is true that in some places, you know, birds are enjoying the absence of people and you know, inhabiting areas that they haven't in the past.
It seems that reading your book that we're in this really exciting time of understanding a lot more about birds, their behavior, their intelligence, and probably getting rid of some old myths that we've had about birds. Help us understand why we're at this particular moment.
Yeah, so it's really an extremely exciting time in bird science and ornithology. And I think we're kind of, all of these discoveries are being spurred by, for three reasons. We have new attitudes, you know, we're overcoming old biases about bird brains and the limitations of their intelligence. Also, outdated perspectives that are rooted in geographical biases and gender biases as well. We're also now blessed with an array of really powerful new tools that are helping us see bird behaviors that have been hidden in the past. And also, there's a new focus on studying bird behavior and intelligence in the wild. And together, these different approaches are really yielding some amazing new insights.
You mentioned the fact that there are more women ornithologists or more women who are doing research on birds. Has that really changed dramatically how we see bird behavior, especially among the females?
It has. You know, until quite recently, most ornithologists were men, and research really did tend to focus on what male birds were up to. And the part played by females was, you know, in everything from ornamental traits to mating systems, was often downplayed or ignored. And now we understand that females actually play a critical role in shaping much of bird behavior and bird traits. And a really good instance of the kind of bias and perspective that we've had is we've assumed, especially in this hemisphere, that that most complex bird song is sung by males. And it turns out it took a team of international women scientists to determine that this is in fact not true, that in 2/3 of songbird species, females sing, and they sing songs that are just as complex and elaborate as male songs.
Well, I do want to play some bird songs, but let me just quote Darwin, who you quote in this book, and he talked about bird songs and communication as, quote, the nearest analogy to human language. So we're really talking about a kind of complex language that birds have developed over the eons.
Yes, and we're because of this new research, we're really toppling old ideas about how much information a bird can convey in its calls and songs. Studying birds such as the common chickadee, the New Holland honeyeater of Australia, these birds convey a tremendous amount of information, especially in their alarm calls.
Well, you mentioned chickadee, and we have a chickadee clip queued up, and I wonder if we could play that. It's just 6 seconds, and then you can deconstruct that for us, if you would, Jennifer. This is a chickadee call. Probably sounds very familiar to our audience. Now, Jennifer, you say the more D's, like chickadee-dee-dee, the more D's, the more alarm?
Yes. So I just want to say these little birds, the calls of chickadees are considered by scientists to be among the most sophisticated and precise systems of communication in any land animal. You know, so chickadees, they use some calls to maintain contact with a mate or announce a nearby food source. But the really remarkable language-like calls are the ones you just heard. And these are alarm calls used to warn of predators. So the chickadee-dee-dee call that gives the bird its name, those warn of a perched predator, like, oh, for instance, an owl sitting in a tree. And the number of those little dee-dee-dees at the end of its call, those indicate a predator's size and hence the degree of threat that it represents. So more dee-dee-dees actually means a smaller, more agile, and therefore more dangerous predator.
That is fascinating. The more D's, the more dangerous, but the smaller the predator.
Correct. The great threat to chickadees is these little predators that can dart in and out of trees and really go after smaller birds. And what's really interesting is that these alarm calls actually recruit birds nearby to mob the predator. And the other species of birds understand the chickadee's language, and they'll join in the mobbing.
Wow. So a kind of a chorus of D's. How many D's can a chickadee go?
Oh, numerous. I mean, I've heard, 10, 11, 12. Wow. But, most of them are, four or five. I often listen now when I pass a chickadee, and it, it's usually just a few D's at the end because I'm this big lumbering presence. I'm not much of a threat.
Do birds, and there are so many species, 10,000 species of birds. Do birds have different dialects, I guess, depending on where they live?
Yes, they do. Just, as much as we have regional accents, depending on where we live. And some of these dialects can be very distinct in very small areas. So you can have one version of a song, another, same species, different songs.
And is that just, it's sort of their ability to adapt to the environment, to the creatures around them? I mean, it's so interesting to think of a dialect adapting itself that way, but that's what humans do.
Yes, and it's also an indication of culture in birds, because birds learn their songs in the same way that we learn language. They learn, it's a process called vocal learning, and it's very rare in the non-avian animal world. And it's a process of listening, imitating, and repeating and practicing. So what young birds do is that they listen to the adult model songs around them, and they learn those songs. So when one sort of population of birds has a particular variation in a song, then the young birds are going to pick that up and learn that version of the song.
Let me play another, and I should say to our listeners that you sent us a couple of these clips so that we could listen to some of these birds. This is the superb lyrebird, L-Y-R-E bird, who has the ability to mimic species in the rainforest. Let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk about it. That's the superb lyrebird, again, mimicking a range of species in the rainforest. Jennifer, that's really extraordinary when you listen to it carefully.
Yes, it was a little hard to hear there, but the bird is mimicking a kookaburra, a currawong, cockatoos, a whipbird, even a whole flock of parrots. And when I stumbled on one of these male birds doing this kind of mimicking display in a rainforest in Australia, and it was really the most remarkable thing I've ever heard in terms of bird song. When you're right up close to it, it is like hearing an orchestra. It's just this booming, resonant, truly astonishing song, and the bird mimics all the bird calls and songs of the rainforest where it lives. And what scientists have learned is that the lyrebird actually uses this astonishing skill at mimicry to lie. So the lyrebird actually lies,
Is the
and it
liar
tricks.
bird.
Yes, it tricks and manipulates other birds, including its own mate, by using this talent for mimicry.
So what does that tell us about this particular bird's intelligence? I mean, the idea of mimicking raises so many questions about intelligence.
Yes, it does. And again, it's another example of this vocal learning. So these birds are very good at vocal learning. And you know, what we're understanding is that their brains are wired in many ways, in similar ways to our brains. And you know, they use some of the same neural pathways that we use to learn language. And you know, it's the thing that I'll say though about the bird brain is that in some ways, it's even more magnificent than ours because it's this miracle of miniaturization. You know, it's dense with neurons, it's super efficient, and it's really capable of these astonishing mental feats.
In fact, they share a large cortex, as you write, as we do.
Yes, it's not organized the way that our cortex is. You know, we have layers of neurons, kind of like a lasagna, but birds have their neurons arranged more like a head of garlic with little cloves. It turns out that they in songbirds and parrots, they have an equal number, sometimes greater number of neurons than mammal brains of the same size, or even primate brains.
We're almost up on a break here, but I guess it's time to retire the phrase bird brain, meaning, stupid or flighty or all the ways that we have used it as a negative, as a pejorative. I think
Yes,
it's time
actually, I
to,
take it
to
as a compliment.
Exactly. Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Jennifer Ackerman. She's a science and nature writer. She's written books about birds, and she's got a new one called The Bird Way, and it's subtitled A New Look at How Birds Talk, Work, Play, Parent, and Think. And we'll be talking about all this diversity of behavior after a very short break. You can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. My guest is science writer Jennifer Ackerman. Again, she's got a new book called The Bird Way, A New Look at How Birds Talk, Work, Play, Parent, and Think. I want to play one more song that you sent us, Jennifer, and this is a duet. It's the Pied Butcher Birds, and they are singing a duet. We'll just give it a little listen, and then I have a question or two for you, and then we got some folks that want to join us. Jennifer, one of the things you said earlier is that We are learning more about how female birds are not dowdy and quiet and kind of boring, but that duets help was one way to understand the role that they play.
Yes, I mean, and actually, if you go to Australia and you ask the people there and the ornithologists about bird song, they say, oh yeah, of course females sing because they have so many duetting species there. So it's a whole different perspective. It's that Southern Hemisphere perspective. Many duetters in the Southern Hemisphere, in Latin America and South America too. So this bird, the Pied Butcher bird, is one of those birds that really made me see the complexity and contradiction in birds, because these birds, they're really ferocious. You know, they skewer these little animals for dinner, but they have this beautiful haunting song, and it's often woven into musical compositions by professional composers.
Well, you can hear the possibilities there when you listen. Let me get a caller to join us, and this is Kate calling us from New Jersey. And Kate, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead, Kate.
I found a crow that had been hit by a car, a young crow. I brought her in my house to get better. She couldn't fly at first, but then she got to where she could fly from one room to another room in a sort of a low arc. I didn't want her to try to fly out a window, obviously, that was glass. So I took her around the room to which she always flew and bopped her nose against the glass and said, window, window, window. I did all the windows where she could get to, except I missed one of a triptych of three windows in a row. For some reason, I just didn't do that one. And sure enough, she went from the farthest room straight for that window. And to show how the birds are capable of abstract thinking, because I yelled window for the one that she'd never seen, never gone out, obviously, before, and she veered off. So
wow.
She knew what the word meant.
That's fascinating. Jennifer, anything we should know about crows in particular?
Well, crows are among the most intelligent birds on the planet. They're in the corvid family, and they really rate at the very top. One of the arguably the world's most intelligent bird is a crow. It's a New Caledonian crow. And these birds are renowned for their incredible problem-solving abilities, their understanding of cause and effect, of basic principles of physics, and they also make and use their own highly sophisticated tools, and really on par with chimps and orangutans. And they also demonstrate an example of culture in birds, which is they have different styles of tool making in different parts of the island of New Caledonia where they live. And these styles of tool making are passed down through the generations. So, you know, the faithful transmission of tool design, that is a very good definition of culture.
Absolutely. And you also write about raptors and their ability to spread fire, but for very specific kinds of reasons.
That's right. You know, these are birds known as fire hawks, and they're really showing us that birds may actually use fire as a tool. Raptors of all kinds, they hunt around wildfires, and basically they feast on the critters that flee the flames. But, you know, it's one thing to feed at an already raging fire. It's quite another to start one yourself. But these Australian raptors, they're whistling kites, black kites, brown falcons, they seem to be doing exactly this. They fly into active fires, they intentionally pick up smoldering sticks, and then they drop them in an unburned area of brush or grass. So they spread the flames to new areas and forage there. And it's, you know, it's really startling behavior, because we thought we were the only species to use fire as a tool.
But there we are. We're talking about raptors. Here's a question from Kathy. She says, cowbirds are raised by other bird species. Why don't they learn the song of the adoptive parent? How do they learn the cowbird vocalizations?
That is such an interesting question. And, I think the whole issue of brood parasites and the way that they... There's some indication that they are they have a hardwired song, and many birds do. It's just that they learn versions of their songs from a song model. But a brood parasite probably has elements of its song in already in its, you know, it's basically in its repertoire. And then learns to sing among its peers and its adult models later.
Well, let's talk about the various bird senses, whether it's seeing or smelling or hearing. You write about the fact that there has been some sensory prejudice in studying birds and that they have a pretty extraordinarily well-adapted sense of smell. Take us inside their sensory system.
Yes. Well, you know, we used to think that birds had a poor sense of smell or no sense of smell at all, really. And we now know otherwise because nearly every bird tested can detect odors. You know, pigeons, quails, hummingbirds, robins, even starlings and house finches. And seabirds have such an extraordinary sense of smell that they can locate their prey by smell over vast distances, and they create a kind of odor map in their heads of these oceanscapes, and they use that odor map to find the krill and other sea creatures that they feed on. There are birds that can find their colonies by scent alone from distances of 500 miles. So it's really a bias that we've had to work hard to overcome.
I'm thinking of those migrating birds when they're flying from here to there, when they're looking down at where they want to go. Let's say it's a rainforest. Do we know what a rainforest looks like to a bird?
Well, it's a really interesting question because what has come out recently on studying color vision in birds is that birds really, their perception of color is entirely different from ours. In fact, one scientist told me that compared with bird color vision, humans are basically colorblind. I mean, we
Wow.
have this very kind of primitive perception of color. And a bird's perception of color is really deeply influenced by its ability to see ultraviolet light. And it's not just that they can see wavelengths of color in a part of the spectrum that we can't see. It's that ultraviolet light is actually baked into all the colors they see. So they kind of experience another whole dimension of color. And it affects everything from how they forage in a flower field, how they see a rainforest, and also, you know, how they see plumage and how they display during courtship.
Which and also explains their ability to navigate. I mean, it's kind of extraordinary when you see those little birds making their way south or north, their ability to pinpoint their landing.
Yeah, navigation is one of those extraordinary phenomena in birds. And, you know, birds, they basically carry the mental equivalent of our GPS, satellite navigation, our compasses, all kinds of navigational devices, basically, but they carry them in their heads. And they use all kinds of information from sun and stars, from magnetic fields, landmarks, all funneled into their brains and used to guide them to where they need to go.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jennifer Ackerman, and we're talking about her new book. It's called The Bird Way, A New Look at How Birds Talk, Work, Play, Parent, and Think. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And we hope to hear from Tyke James, who's a birder. He grew up in Philadelphia. Will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. In the meantime, let me looks like he's good to go. Let me just get Rob from Brooklyn to join our conversation, and then we'll get Tyke James on the phone. And Rob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times, calling us from Brooklyn.
Hi.
Hi.
I used to be awakened regularly at midnight by a very loud bird, and it was followed by a different kind of bird. And then I realized that these bird songs are not overlapping, so they're coming from a mockingbird. I was wondering what your guest has to say comparing the lyrebird's mimicry to our local mockingbirds.
Thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yes, the mockingbird is actually one of my favorite examples of mimicry. They really are astonishing mimics. Once I was it was winter. It was in November, and I had to wait outside for some reason or other, and I heard all of this different bird song coming from this bush. And I thought, wow, there's just a great collection of birds in that bush. Well, it was just a mockingbird. They are really astonishing mimics. I think what's different is that the quality of the lyrebird's voice and the accuracy of its mimicry. So the lyrebird can actually fool the species of bird whose song it's imitating into thinking that song is being given by a member of its own species. Now, the mockingbird has a pretty good mimicking skill, but it's not that accurate.
Well, joining us now is Tyke James, and he was introduced to birding growing up in Philadelphia, actually leading groups in Cobbs Creek Park. He's Government Affairs Coordinator for the National Audubon Society, one of the organizers of the Black Birders Week, which was held in early June. And this was in response to a white woman named Amy Cooper calling the cops on a black man, Christian Cooper, obviously not related to each other. Christian Cooper was birding in Central Park and had done nothing wrong. And this incident went viral, shed light on everyday racism on birding while black. And Tyke James, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome.
Big, big fan.
Nice to have both of you with us. Tyke, you grew up in West Philadelphia, in Philadelphia. When and how did you get interested in birding?
Well, I always like to say that birding was my first job as an environmental educator at Cobbs Creek. I was a senior in high school at Motivation High, and this young man named Tony Crosdale came in with Dan Kubza to recruit me and some other high school youth for this program that would pay you, basically, to learn about environmental education and how to interpret ecology with a great focus on birds. My first assignment was studying a kingfisher. And when I first saw the female belted kingfisher and a cattail do the call and cross the creek, that was a moment that I was so present for, but I did not know that it would lead me down the path of conservation that I'm currently on. So I always like to say birding was my first job, and it what got me on the path of conservation.
Well, that's a great story. Jennifer, I know you grew up in Washington, D.C. It was your dad, I think, who introduced you to birding.
That's right. Yeah, I was about 7 or 8 years old, and he would take me down to the CNO Canal along the Potomac River, and we'd birdwatch. And I was one of 5 girls, and so it was a great way of spending time alone with my dad, was to get out there and birdwatch with him. And it sounds like Tyke's spark bird was a belted kingfisher, which is just a magnificent bird, and mine was a chickadee. So I didn't know it at the time. I was young, but I was just so intrigued by this little bold little bird. You know, they'll land on your hand, and they'll eat from from your hand. So it did get me started on, and you know, I just fell in love with birds from that very young age.
Well, and then clearly you don't have to go to the Amazon to find birds. I mean, they're all over our urban environments. Tyke, let me go back to you and go back to Black Birders Week and what happened to Christian Cooper in Central Park. First of all, has that ever happened to you, or any version of something like that happened to you while you were birding?
Absolutely. And it is an unfortunate reality that the black experience is at best questioned and at worst threatened when I'm seeking the same enjoyment of birds that, you know, I think everyone should be able to enjoy. Without calling a specific story, I know that a lot of my birding when I was younger, when I started it as a job, it involved initially doing bird walks with my neighbors. Mm-hmm. And there were never any issues when I would do bird walks with my neighbors. It would become an issue when I would go outside the city, when I would go to New Jersey, or when I would go to the Poconos, and there were less black people, you know, and there were less people that looked like me. And so often the standard for inclusivity and the standard for belonging is would be very different. And navigating that is a challenge and a burden that's, you know, again, unfortunately, part of the experience of birding while black.
Do you think Black Birders Week is a good first step to deal with that kind of racism and discrimination?
Absolutely. I think that the Black Birders Week advanced the narrative that the Black experience goes beyond trauma. The Black experience has pride, strength, resilience, and style. And I think that with what impact we started with Black Birders Week, I think that we can see that the organizations, the environmental organizations especially, that benefited from this and supported it, they should see more clearly that they cannot achieve environmental progress without addressing systemic racism and white supremacy.
Jennifer, do you want to weigh in on this at all as a birder yourself and someone who has written so passionately about birds?
Absolutely. And I want to thank Tyke because I actually during Black Birders Week, I watched several roundtables, and one of them was led by Tyke and had Christian Cooper and Karina Newsom, Jason Ward. And it was, talking about the joy that they take in nature, the scientific work they do, and the racism they've experienced. And those accounts were really illuminating and sobering. You know, it's such a violation of the basic right to outdoors, to access to nature, without harassment or discrimination. And I have to say, I think we have a lot of work to do to make the world and the birding world safe and welcoming for Black, Brown, and Indigenous people. You know, traditionally, birding and bird science, too, have really been overwhelmingly white worlds. And we really need to change these spaces, change their nature and their structure so that they embrace human diversity as emphatically and as joyfully as they embrace the diversity of birds.
Well, I want to pick up on that because I want to put a couple questions to Tyke James and carry on our conversation with Jennifer Ackerman. We are talking about birds and birding, and you can join us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're going to talk a bit more about some of the politics at play here and much more after that. Stay with us. This is Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Tyke James. He works for the National Audubon Society. He's got a podcast called Brothers in Birding, and he was one of the organizers of Black Birders Week, which was in early June in response to racism within the birding community, and Jennifer Ackerman with us as well. And again, she's got a new book called The Bird Way. Tyke, just one or two more questions before we have to say goodbye to you, but picking up on what Jennifer was saying, sort of taking a page from the bird world, the diversity of the bird world, and applying it to the birder world. What do we need to do to make the birding world more welcoming to people of color?
There's a long list of things, and I want to start with using some words of my fellow Philadelphian, my friend Karina Newsom. Birding is a hope-giving activity. For many reasons, for a legacy of decisions and for the legacy of white supremacy in this country, there are barriers for that activity. And I think that the birding community, especially those in leadership, especially those in institutions, organizations that lead the culture and that define what birding is, they have a very big responsibility to take actions and make decisions now so that the future generation of this birding community, one that we know will be more diverse, because we know that by 2050, the people of the global majority will in so many words, switch.
Sure.
And so we have to think and hold to account that these birding organizations that are leading the community will have to make decisions that eradicate the barriers to the hope-giving activity that birding provides for so many people.
I'm curious, how white is Audubon, the National Audubon
Society?
How
white? I think it's about, last time I saw the stats, maybe 80%, maybe 70%. Mm-hmm. I hope they don't come out to it with a statement and quote me, but I could definitely follow up in an email with the exact stats. But yeah, Audubon is one of those majority white organizations, an organization that, you know, again, unlike others, benefited from perpetuating white supremacy, has a history of benefiting from land theft and directly and indirectly from the historic enslavement of my ancestors.
Is there a bird that you, Taiki, that you identify with?
I mean, I really like the cardinal. Whenever I have a walkie-talkie, that's always my code name. And it's because cardinal. The cardinal is a bird that you can appreciate year-round. It's a bird that can mean, they can have such a symbol for hope and such a symbol for brilliance. And it's the male and female. I think that the first time I saw a female cardinal, I thought it was like a phoenix bird of some sort because it just seemed like it was on fire, you know, and I was just, it was just so exciting to see. So, I would relate back to the cardinal.
Well, Taiki James, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times and for the work that you do. And I hope there's will there be another Black Birders Week?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's going to have to, you know, the calendar is going to roll around again. And, right. You know, one of the aspirations I've been throwing out is if Black Birders Week included the most popular family in America. I'm talking about the Obamas, not the Kardashians.
We're going to leave it there. Taiki James, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And Jennifer Ackerman staying with us for the rest of the hour. And it's so interesting and so important what Taiki was saying, certainly about this issue of race, which, of course, is permeating our entire society, always has. But now it's out in the front, out in the open. And it seems, you know, we have a choice. We have an opportunity to address some of these, you know, longstanding injustices, including, I guess, in the birding world.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one place to start is by listening to Black voices about their experiences. And I think that Black Birding Week was just so helpful in that regard. And also, I think, you know, by supporting Black, Brown, Indigenous-led movements of all kinds, you know, including environmental and climate justice organizations that are really addressing root causes of environmental injustice and climate change. You know, there's the Climate Justice Alliance that campaigns for implementing practices and policies that support ways of working and living in harmony with the planet. And, you know, my feeling here is that until we're all safe, Black, Brown, Indigenous, none of us are safe.
You know, I'm thinking we did shows about this, about the loss of songbirds because of climate change. We've had this, you know, short-term lull because there's less traffic. I mean, you can literally, not today, but you can see that the skies have been actually bluer. I don't think it's going to stay that way, but how much of our future is tied to the future of our avian friends?
Well, I think in many ways they are the proverbial canaries in the coal mine. And, you know, we've had really terrible losses in the bird world. And and I feel strongly that we need to take some action now. There's some things going on that are really threatening the well-being of birds right now, rolling back the rollbacks in really vital environmental policies that protect birds, you know, the kind of restricting the reach of the Endangered Species Act, gutting the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and the most recent one is a rollback of the Coastal Barrier Resources Act, which was, you know, legislation designed to protect beaches from dredging and mining and keep the sand that nesting birds need in place. So these kinds of rollbacks will really have a long-term impact, and I think it's going to be deeply damaging for birds and for people.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from actually producer John Ahrens. He says, the Pittsburgh aviary is an amazing place, highly recommended. A comment from Avi. A month ago, we discovered that a family of eastern screech owls has settled on a tree near our main door, parents and 3 or 4 chicks. We've been watching them every night from 8 p.m. to 8:30. Also, a question from John. Can your guest speak to the songs and intelligence of seagulls? Jennifer?
Oh, seagulls. Actually, there's a very interesting scale of bird intelligence that was devised by a scientist named Louis Lefebvre. He's Canadian, and he was looking at the way that birds innovate, how they find new solutions to old problems. And he found that this was a good way of measuring bird intelligence in the wild, you know, not in a laboratory. And he went through 75 years of journals, ornithological journals, looking for these little reports about birds doing really innovative kinds of things. And seagulls, it turns out, were way at the top, along with, you know, herons. Very top were the corvids, but then there raptors, herons, gulls. They're very innovative in their behavior. And this sort of innovation, it's called behavioral flexibility, and it's a very good indicator of intelligence.
Interesting. Again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499 about anything related to birds with our guest, Jennifer Ackerman. Going back to your book, there's a fascinating chapter on birds and play, and you know, makes you wonder, so what the heck is play compared to work? But I guess play is for one's own amusement, self-amusement. Help us understand, there are several species. There's some parrots, the clowns of the mountains, there's the raven, other birds that seem to engage in what we would call play.
Yeah, in fact, it's very common in the bird world, play is. You know, all kinds of birds play. They're warblers and pelicans. They throw pebbles, cormorants, and green herons toss sticks in the air and leaves. Some birds that love to slide down snowy banks, or penguins love to slide down ice floes the way that otters jump on water slides. So there's lots of play in the bird world. You mentioned the raven. They're one of the most playful animals on the planet. They look so dour and serious, but they're very, very playful. And, you know, birds really play for a variety of reasons. Sometimes to hone, you know, vital life skills, sometimes to train for the unexpected, and very likely also to reduce stress and develop a healthy brain. Wow. So the key of it, you mentioned this parrot from New Zealand, is probably the king of play in the bird world. And these birds put play to great use for social purposes. It's a really interesting story.
You also write about love, you know, mating and building nests and building families. And you talk about the kind of quote unquote outrageous and ornate mating displays. And we have all seen examples of that. Why so elaborate for certain birds for some of these mating displays?
Well, it comes back to the females, as we were discussing before, mm-hmm. and their role in shaping bird behavior. Females are often the ones who select a male to mate with, and through natural selection, they have been the movers and shapers of these very elaborate and bizarre, sometimes very bizarre displays. One of my favorites is the displays of the bowerbirds, which is a family of Australian birds, Australia, New Guinea, and these birds build these very elaborate bowers that are like little arches made of sticks, and wow. then adorned with an array of beautiful objects that the birds collect. And each species of bowerbird has its favorite color of objects, and the females come around. They visit the various bowers of these male bowerbirds, and they pick the one who puts on the best show. They pick the male who puts on the best show. So in this way, the genes are perpetuated for these kind of elaborate displays.
Sounds like the dating game, doesn't it?
Indeed.
That old TV show. Here's a question from Kate. Can your guest speak to the connection of birds to dinosaurs?
Birds are dinosaurs. It's one of those amazing facts that just kind of blows you away. But birds descend from a group of dinosaurs called the theropod dinosaurs. And they were one line of dinosaurs that somehow survived whatever cataclysm did in their cousins, their big lumbering cousins. And these birds, these ancestors of birds, are they were the beginning of all our songbirds and every species of bird on the planet. So it's very hard to think about birds as dinosaurs, but that's exactly what they are.
Wow. I'm watching my clock here, and I don't have time to take more calls, but let me just ask you what Sarah, a caller from Philadelphia, wanted to ask you. She says, blue jays seem to have a greater sense of community than other birds. Can you speak to that, Jennifer?
Yes, blue jays are a very social species, and in fact, many jays are. There's the scrub jays, and very social birds. Now, in our blue jays don't breed communally, but the scrub jays in Florida, they do. They actually raise their young together in family groups. So the variety of social behaviors in birds is just fascinating. You know, you have your loners, and then you have birds that almost never leave their social group. You know, parrots are often like that. They're very, very social birds, and they develop this incredible array of kinds of calls that they use, social calls they use to identify each other. And so it's really fascinating social intelligence.
Edward reminds us about Cape May and the World Series of bird watching. Do you participate in that, Jennifer?
I don't. I'm not what you call a birder. I'm not a lister.
You're not?
No, I'm much more interested in the behavior of the birds in my backyard than I am in going out to get species on my list. I'm absolutely appreciate those people, and I know they love what they do, and that's great. But my interest really is behavior. So I'm really focused on that.
Do you have another book in the works?
I do. I have another bird book.
Do you really?
Focused on, it's focused on a family of birds that are ubiquitous and much loved.
Oh,
and that's all I'll say.
Okay. All right. Stay tuned, I guess it should be. Well, Jennifer Ackerman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And again, her book is called The Bird Way, A New Look at How Birds Talk, Work, Play, Parent, and Think. She also wrote a book that came out a couple of years ago called The Genius of Birds. And as she just indicated, there's another bird book in the wings. And we also talked with Tyke James, who grew up in Philadelphia, actually, and works for the National Audubon Society, one of the organizers of the first Black Birders Week. And go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. And we do want to close things out. We've got Lullaby of Birdland, sung by Sarah Vaughan. Enjoy.
Always hear when you sigh. Never in my word land could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Have you ever heard two turtle doves, bill and coo, when they love? That's the kind of magic music we make with our lips when we kiss. And there's a weepy old willow, he really knows how to cry. That's how I'd cry on my pillow if you should tell me farewell and goodbye. Lullaby of birdland, whisper low, kiss me sweet and we'll go. Flying high in birdland, high in the sky up above, all because we're in love.